Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Mug Recap here on Memorial Day, May 25th, 2015. I am Y Ruler of Time, joined as ever by Rillo T. Chris, how's your weekend been?
It's been busy. It's been a very busy weekend. I spent most of today doing yard work. I don't know, Nick, if you ever have had to do gardening, mulching.
Yard work is literally like...
Weed blocking.
Yard work is what they do in hell. In my opinion, basically.
I don't mind most of it.
Just 24 hours, 7 days a week yard work. That is my hell.
I really don't mind doing it so much. I usually just throw on some podcasts and I'll go in and get into it. But I was doing that for about 5 hours. I came back, I went out and got a run in, like a, you know, not a long run, only like 2 miles, but just a quick run in. And I plan to do an actual bodyweight routine workout this evening. And none of that matters because I had Arby's for lunch, and I feel like I ruined my week off of that one meal. I'm just like, oh, God. Every time, like, you know, when you belch and, like, you taste something that you had, it's just been nonstop, like, Arby's for, like, the past day. I'm like, come on, man.
It's got to be something they put on their sandwiches or some shit, or maybe in their fries, because I feel the same thing every time I eat that, too.
It's taunting me, I feel like. Arby's is making me suffer.
I did a lot of work at the ballpark this past week, and it was long shifts. Sometimes I was there for long enough to like have to eat two meals. Oof. And when you are in my situation where you have a car that allows you to eat there for free, you take advantage of it. But even so, it's like, this is, you know, the lowest grade food you can get, you know, crap that they have in a freezer and then they, you know, just heat it up. Or they fry it right there or some shit. Bad enough to be eating that once a day. Sometimes I was going to eat it twice a day. And I was like, ugh, I feel bad about this.
I went to, because I have not had, ever since I changed my diet up, I have not had hot dogs since then. Because I realized hot dogs are, like, just, like, the worst food out there. Like, I was like, there's no meat in this. But, like, the one time I was tempted to have one is we were at a baseball game. And I imagine, in your situation, you're like, no, I fucking hate hot dogs now because they're just everywhere. Hot dogs and Cracker Jacks can go to hell.
Well, there are two different places that serve the hot dogs. One place is terrible, the other one actually grills them before serving them to you. That place is pretty great.
Okay.
So long as you don't show up, you know, when nobody's been buying them, and so they've just been sitting there for a while. Did that once, didn't enjoy it. But normally they're good. But yeah, it's bad when you're just eating, like, the same five things, and you end up doing it like day after day after day. But anyway, we have a lot of talking to get through, so I think we should just get into it. We are finally talking about Toaru Gagaku no Railgun, mm-hmm. A certain scientific railgun which we have been reading over the course of the last few weeks, and this was one of those cases where we took the suggestion, then we were like, well, wait a minute, which of these are we going to read, actually? We thought we had a bit of a Higurashi on our hands again. Turns out, not quite the case. As someone who helped me explain to us, basically, the characters and setting between Railgun and the original series, A Certain Magical Index, are the same. But the way they explained it was, basically, it's almost like having simultaneously running comic book titles, where sometimes the cast and you know, seats and story elements of one will be mentioned in another. Sometimes one set of characters will cross over into the other, and so on and so forth. It just so happens that they focus on two different characters to different degrees. So, Index was technically the original series. It's okay, though. Railgun did not, you know, take away from our understanding of the main characters and what was going on.
No, she, like, you meet Toma, who's the main character, and you pretty quickly kind of get a grasp on who he is, what his power is, and that's all you really need.
And I have to say, I think that I would have actually preferred to read Index because he seemed more interesting to me. I could, that's not to say that Misaki, main character in Railgun, who is actually the namesake of the series because she has psychic electrical powers, and she can actually shoot metal the way that an electromagnet works, so she can shoot stuff like a railgun. She's not a bad character, I don't think.
No, she's good.
I think her supporting cast is horrible.
All right, her supporting cast is okay when all of the comedy is removed from it and they're trying to make it serious, but any point where they're trying to show these people just being, like, friendly, you know, schoolmates, all of them are just these weird, like, one of them is constantly trying to, like, hit on her. One of them, her sole gimmick is flipping up her friend's skirt.
And the friend whose skirt gets her skirt... The friend whose skirt gets flipped, her whole thing is that she is shy.
Yeah, she's like, fucking, she's like, please don't flip up my skirt, flip, no. Like, you're just like, what a bitch. What an asshole. Your friend begs you not to do it, and you do it anyway.
And yeah, but like you mentioned, the main character's best friend, and thus kind of the second most important character in the series, her main thing is she has a, you know, same-sex crush on her. And it's not a, you know, good, romantic same-sex crush. She just molests her.
She's just like,
repeatedly.
I wore slutty lingerie, and she didn't even care. She just must not love me. You're just like, alright, I see what this is. And I think part of this is the magazine this runs in, because every so often I caught, like, shots of, like, magazine covers from it, and they all had, like, a lot of, like, animu girls in, you know, like, you know, fucking
provocative poses
or, like, you know, fetish costumes or just, like, you know, like, fucking, you know, shit like that. And I was like, okay, so maybe this is just part and parcel for the kind of magazine that this runs in, but it really does detract from everything when you're like, oh, this is, you know, her friend, she's gonna go out there to protect her, and oh wait, she teleported into her while she's bathing and talked about how small her boobs are. And you're like, oh man, come on.
What really threw me about that whole thing was that early on they meet this character who, her whole thing is that she has no sense of what is appropriate for certain situations. So she feels hot, so she decides to just start stripping her clothes off so that she'll cool off. And of all people, Kuroko, the lesbian schoolgirl crush girl, is freaked out by this. And it's like, but you're constantly doing the same thing to Misaki! What the hell?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a weird double standard for it. And the thing is, like, when you take the way... when you take away Misaki, when you take away what she's doing to her, when you just take away that part of it, you're like, okay, this character in her own situations is kind of cool. Like, there's a scene you have early on, because her power is basically, like, teleportation, but not just limited to herself. Like, she can teleport other things. And if she does so, it pushes out whatever she put the teleport object in. So she has this fight against, I don't know, like a random thug. And she has this cool fight where she's, like, basically destroying a building by teleporting windows into, like, pillar, like, column pillars. And you're like, okay, she, you know, power's cool here. She seems like a kind of, you know, smart, you know, creative character. But at any time...
One of her things is that she, like, carries, like, needles around. So she'll just teleport them into, like, people's clothing in order to pin them to stuff.
Yeah. And you're just...
She can do that because they can pierce anything because she just teleports them into surfaces and stuff.
Yeah.
So, cool stuff.
Yeah, and then, you know, you like her in those aspects, and then she'll see Misaki again, and she'll be like, I brought your swimsuit so you can change into it right here in front of me! And you're like, alright, I guess we'll do this again. And it was the doctor, too, was a weird one, because you catch her early on, too, and her gimmick at the start, you know, before, spoilers, she turns out to be more than meets the eye, her gimmick is that it's really hot out, so she's going to take off her clothes no matter, you know, where she is. And kind of like Gray, but obviously... you know,
played for
sexual more purposes. Than
haha, that's funny, and I'm also jacking off under the table.
Yeah. While I'm reading this at the library.
Well, in fairness, a certain group would do that with Gray, too.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
He's a good-looking guy.
Yeah, he's studly. Have you seen those side apps? Mm.
I actually really felt about this in a lot of respects the same way I felt about Black Lagoon. Because there is something of an ongoing plot in Railgun, but mostly it is about a series of cases that these guys have to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And it centers around a, you know, a combat-oriented series that features a lot of girls that are, in some cases, you know, portrayed sexually, in a lot of cases portrayed sexually, but also they do a lot of the ass-kicking and such. And... in the same respect, I didn't really like it too much, but I can see how people could. Because, it's, like you said, it's not bad combat. And the way that the powers are thought out, it seems like, okay, they've actually, you know, they have this kind of broad spectrum of things that they can do that are confined around one gimmick, I guess you could say. Misaka's whole thing is electricity. Kuroko's whole thing is teleportation, but they use their powers in a lot of different ways, which, you know, means that they've been practicing using their powers for a very long time. So, you get that, but I really didn't find myself caring too much about the characters themselves and what they were going through. So, I had a hard time getting into the series, I will admit.
I think I enjoyed Misaka and a lot of the cast when they were taken away from, like, the whole, you know, not slice of life, but just the generic, like, hey, we're walking around a school or walking around a store, we're gonna, you know, talk about, you know, fucking whatever bullshit we're talking about. When they actually get into, like, oh, hey, a monster's destroying downtown, or hey, this giant, you know, horrible plot's happening, we need you to get involved. I thought there was when we started to get glimpses of a pretty interesting story. It's not, it's a story that has kind of heavy elements to it, but it never plays them for shock value or anything like that. You know, if a character is going to get killed, it's not like, oh, hey, we just ripped this person's head off because we wanted to show you how seriously badass this villain is or anything like that. It's not a bloody, gory series in that aspect. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy it. It's just something I think I enjoy more as I've kind of refined what I've read. But I think there are parts where I'm like, this is a cool character. This is a cool concept. This is an entire subplot where Misaka has basically like almost 10,000 clones of herself out there.
Right.
And the only reason they exist is so that they can test the abilities of another ability user by having him kill her over and over again, essentially. Yeah. And she realizes this, and her plan is to fight him. But she's like, you know, she's already heard, you're going to lose 186 moves. That's what we predicted you'll do against this. And her plan, she's like, I'm going to go in and fucking dive on the first move, because that'll make them think that the project was a failure and something about this was wrong, and restart the whole thing. And, you know, they don't have the resources for that. And, you know, it's this weird kind of thought process of, like, I don't think it's going to work the way you hope that will, but you're still like, okay, I can see what you're going for.
You're going to throw a monkey wrench in their plans.
And you're putting in an interesting, you know, thought process into there of, like, hey, is my life worth it if it saves these 10,000? You know, what's the life of a clone? What's the value of a clone? And you get some cool, you know, alternate thoughts there from Toma? Whatever his fucking name, the index guy. You get some cool thoughts from him as well. And it has a cool conclusion, although, oddly enough, Toma's the one who gets, like, the big moment in it, as opposed to the actual protagonist. And regardless, those moments...
Well, it's because he's the protagonist of the other series.
Yeah, I know. And then the fucking villain becomes a protagonist in another series as well. But it is still cool. It is actually kind of like a comic book universe. But it is still, in those moments, I still like it. I still think it's cool. And I actually like Misaka a lot as a character. I thought she's probably one of the only characters that really felt rounded out of her cast. Because she's, you know, she's...
You can see that she had been a character before this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she would probably be better suited to the role as, I don't know, I guess she was like the fourth most important character in Index. And if for no other reason than the fact that she would be free of fucking Kuroko bothering her all the time.
It would be. Because she is cool. She's, you know, she's a strong, competent character, but she also has, you know, these faults to her. She has this ridiculous affection for childish things that she refuses to admit to because she thinks it'll make herself look weak or, you know, pathetic or things like that. And, you know, it gets played for laughs at some point, but also gets played for some serious moments at times here and there. And there are cool moments regarding her. You're like, oh, cool, I can really see, like, a full character in motion here. And then you're like, oh, hey, and here comes her rapist lesbian friend to pop up and molest her in the shower again. Oh, sweet, I can't wait for this. You're like, all right. Look, I was never a 14-year-old girl in a high school, so maybe these things happened all the time, but this is just weird.
Think of it this way. It's like, if you were in the boys' locker room when you were 14 and a guy molested you like that, you would not think it was funny.
Yeah, Nick, but at the same time, I saw a girl gift another girl a pair of underwear, so my, like, processes of, like, well, man, male and male, male, like, interaction between friends...
Oh, you went to Catholic school.
Yeah. I'm like, what's this? What are you doing? You can't buy another person underwear if they're not your mom. Like, your mom buying them for you because you must wear them? This is insanity. People only do that in the pornography videos.
In the pornography.
In the devil's no-no touch movies I've heard so much about.
Yeah, I did like some aspects of Misaka's character. I liked that they established early on that she, like, just wears shorts under her skirt. And you think it's like, well, okay, she is a schoolgirl at this weird academy that is attended pretty much exclusively by psychic students or some shit like that, which is a really weird concept and seems to exist solely so that you can have those terrible slice-of-life moments that we hate. And I like that, you know, very practical aspect of her character. And I like that despite that practicality, she, you know, got really pissed off when she felt that Toma had one-upped her and created this whole one-sided rivalry entirely inside her head and such, and stuff like that. So, it was definitely good stuff for some characters, but I think that the mere fact that this had to be expanded to a group of new characters, because the ones in Index, you know, could not just be used all the time, otherwise, you know, why bother changing the focus of the series, really probably dragged it down. I'm not saying that I want us to immediately jump into a certain magical index and start reading that now, but my prediction at this time, and it's, you know, nothing that I have any evidence to support, is we would probably like it better.
Yeah, it's very possible. I think this series is still very good. I don't know if I'd necessarily read it for amusement at this point. I think I'd only read it if it was a recommendation. Right. But I still enjoyed it. I still enjoyed reading it. I think if it was just a stronger side cast to it and a bit more of, like, an emphasis of, like, here's a plot that's going on as opposed to, like, here are episodes going on that don't seem like they end, and you're just like, well, what's the end goal for this? You know, what's coming on? Because actually, like a comic book, you just feel like you're kind of getting arcs that don't have necessarily an ending to them.
Right. And it might also be the fact that it is a side series that maybe Index has a stronger sense of direction. Maybe it doesn't. Yeah. I don't know.
We could be talking about Index, and Index could be a billion. Maybe he has a gay, like gay fucking rapist friend who also teleports on him in the shower, but he's like even more flamboyant and wacky. Like, we're just like, wow, I really wish he'd go back to fucking the other girl.
For all we know, a certain magical index is actually just freezing, but with different titles.
It's very possible we could be walking into something horrifying.
If that is the case, don't make us read it, please. I swear to God.
But I still want to say, I still like it. I'm still glad we read it. I can see it absolutely why people, because I believe it was on a recommendation, someone, you know, they said, Misaka is my favorite female protagonist. And, you know, I won't go that far, but I could certainly say, yeah, I could see why someone would like her a lot. She seems to have a lot of admirable traits to her. There's just things in the series that hold it back.
Yeah, I agree basically completely. I think I have a somewhat lower opinion of it than you do. Not very much lower, but it's for all the same reasons you mentioned.
Yeah.
So maybe Index is good. I don't know. We'll find out. Never. I don't know.
You're like, oh, but our recommendation this week is Index. Shit, I should have read that one more closely.
God damn it. I'm the one who chose this. How did this happen? So yeah, with that said, pretty short talk about it, but oh well.
If
there were an ongoing plot, we would have been talking about this for much longer.
Or if there were more, like, character, like, really, I can't think, do the other two characters even do anything? Like, beyond flip her skirt up, and then the other girl's like, I'm sick and I have no powers, and that's, like, my character thing, which really doesn't go anywhere anyway.
Yeah, what the hell?
So, I mean, like, yeah, there's just not that much to talk, like, you know, the first plot's the, you know, mind link thing, and then after that, it's the whole scientist girl, or the clone girls. I mean, there's a character in that, Accelerator, who also gets his own series, I think.
Really? Jeez.
Taru something Accelerator. I thought he got his own series as well, so I don't. I mean, there's cool stuff there. Again, it's tough to really.
And also, we're just not very passionate about the stuff we did dislike.
Yeah. So. Oh, we were passionate about being like, what? This fucking girl is weird.
But nonetheless. But I've seen worse.
So yes, yeah. It was almost, like, charming in how innocently annoying it was.
Oh, you think that this is pushing boundaries.
I'm like, oh, she teleports in on her when she's showering? Let me show you this scene from Freezing.
Let me show you this scene from Arachnid, where a girl literally slithers out of her bonds just to drip her weirdness over the other
side. I forgot about that. She literally had to, like, bondage tie her up at night just to keep her from molesting her in her sleep, and she'd still get out of it.
Now that's a real lesbian stalker story. Oh god, Arachnid was bad. Okay, let's move on to the recap
point. I want, like, another I want, like, a lesbian romance series where it's just, like, there's no sexual element to it at all. It's just, like, god, I dated this girl, and she's such a fucking bitch. She never buys groceries. Like, it's just, like, a real relationship. Like, she never buys groceries. She fucking doesn't do anything. Like, I hate this. This is awful. She fucking hangs out with all of her friends. Like, there's nothing sexual about it. And everyone's like, man, when do they get naked and have pillow fights? Never. But this fucking bitch never talks about her feelings. Yeah, she's just like, she taped over my fucking episodes of Veep. I hadn't watched them yet. I don't know what's happening with Don. Did he get his job back? Who knows? Is Hugh Laurie still vice president? What's happening?
Okay, now let's move on. Recap portion, weekly manga recap, beginning with Black Clover. Chapter, page 14, sorry. Friends. Last time, Luck was squaring off against Shadow Guy with weird mustache and goatee, whose name I've forgotten. And Luck has exceeded his expectations and is looking like a weird frog alien guy with this weird posture. He's got gauntlets and stuff on his arms and legs. He's kind of crouching over weirdly. This is primarily a Luck flashback chapter, but we don't get a very clear idea of everything that's going on. It's clear that he's from some sort of common background, and he managed to defeat a noble in a school's magic exchange competition, which apparently had never happened in the history of it happening. But somehow, through the course of his earlier training, he was abused by some sort of female instructor. I think it might be his mom. Might be his mother, might be a sister or something like that. And she's, you know, slapping him around for failing, and despite the fact that he's being abused, he's just constantly smiling at her, and she's getting upset that he's never getting angry or upset with her. And this was something that just continued on and on throughout his entire career. She was, of course, very happy when he defeated a noble and was all, yes, you did it, you're hugging him and stuff. Now you just gotta keep right on winning. Win, win, and keep on winning. And that's a mantra that Luck has in his head, even up to this day, as he's just going after this guy, lashing at him over and over again, and never being deterred. Up until, finally, he manages to bind him in this binding cross prison with his smoke magic, and it seems to finally hold him in place with solid smoke! Which sounds like some sort of Metal Gear Solid character.
It might be. He probably runs around in a codpiece and the fucking nipple tassels. Knowing the way that series has gone recently.
Then we cut over to the gem guy, who had attacked Yuno's group and managed to take out... What's her name? The healer chick. I don't care. But she's fine. She's just, like, sewing up this giant plant cradle thing around herself, and it's like, dream healing flower cradle! It's like, well... Yeah, okay, I guess she's okay. But they're like...
They're all like, damn, this guy's played MOBAs before he went right for the healer.
Yeah, good call, right? Yeah. So, he then continues to attack. Douchebag Glasses guy uses steel creation magic to block a wave of diamond stuff. And so he and Yuno try and work together to take him down. Asta and Noelle keep running down a corridor, and they hear fighting going on, and Noelle senses that it's probably Luck fighting with someone, and so Asta's like, okay, well, we should go and help him, but Noelle says, well, I don't know if we, you know, have to do that, because, you know, he's good, and he thinks he knows what he's doing and such, and we gotta go after the treasure and so on. So Asta is left to think about this, and at the same time as this is going on, Douchebag Glasses guy tells Yuno to go and find the treasure as well, as he'll hold off the diamond guy, and Yuno's like, I don't think you can beat him without my help, and he's like, do it, fuck you!
Trying to stop me.
So, basically, we're left with a kind of parallel situation where the two experienced guys seem to be getting beaten down. Douchebag Glasses guy gets his leg caught in diamond, and a wave of diamonds is crashing towards him. Luck is trying to break out, but he can't manage to do so, and the guy's hanging for the kill. And as this is happening, Luck is thinking to himself, oh, I've got to keep on winning or else I won't get what I want. But what was it that I wanted? Which I'm sure that at the end of this whole adventure, I'll be like, now I remember, or some shit like that.
He's like, I wanted Nutella on the go. Handy cracker form that I could just dip into.
If I don't beat this guy, there will be no more Twinkies!
They have to get the factory back running! They're like, Twinkies didn't go out of business. They're still making them. He's like, oh, phew.
Yeah. He immediately just stops smiling. Well, I guess I don't have to win anymore.
He quits the guild. He leaves the story.
And he was never seen again.
The box of Twinkies just learned.
Master, why'd you tell him that? We were stealing all the newspaper so he wouldn't see that headline.
Oops.
We know he's mentally unstable, but he's a great mage and he helps us out a lot.
He kicks people a lot. He just wants Twinkies. You dangle it just in front of his face and you keep him going. Asshole.
He's like a monkey on a bicycle. Come on. So both Asta and Yuno make the decision to go and help their guildmates rather than going after treasure. Asta uses his sword to break through the smoke, and Yuno blasts through the wall of crystals, heading towards Douchebag Glasses guy. And so when they're asked, who are you? They both say, his friend! And they both, you know, remember that it's important to take care of their friends and stuff. It's a weird thing because it was halfway through it turned into a parallels sort of chapter where they're so similar in different ways, even though they seem to be so different. But because it was combined with Luck's flashback thing, it wasn't as strong all the way through the chapter, so it felt kind of awkward by the end of it.
I would say I like what... I completely forgotten the mangaka's name. Anyway, the mangaka behind Black Clover. I feel like his writing right now is being more daring. I think he's trying different things. He placed what seems to be a pretty heavy backstory on Locke, you know, this idea that he was abused, presumably by his parental figure. I mean, it's a lot of kind of what we saw or we're seeing recently with Todoroki and then My Hero Academia, where you're like, oh, it's this, you know, parental figure who is warping this person's mind and really doing damage to them by having these, you know, crazy expectations of them. And it doesn't seem to be holding back or anything like that. You know, he smiles because he didn't know how else to react to his parents smacking him or, you know, this woman smacking him. And you're like, okay, that's cool. And I do kind of like the idea of like, hey, you know, this chapter was this duality of Yuno and Asta both working to save their friends because they have a connection to their guild. And I like that. It's just the same problem that the series had, this has from the beginning. I don't care about Asta or Yuno. Like,
yeah.
They're not interesting to me. And when you've now given me this flashback, I'm like, oh, Luck is this cool character.
Luck is interesting. Noelle is interesting. I want to know more about Captain Yami because he's been built up really cool.
But you just need something behind Asta. This isn't like the thing with Naruto that made him compelling is you're like, this kid came from nothing and he's the absolute underdog. And there's that same kind of attitude with Asta, but without like an actual backstory beyond he's an orphan and he's annoying. And you're like, yeah, but like, I need something more because I don't like this kid, but everyone else does. So I don't know. I can't get behind his emotional moments the way I want to. And the execution because of it is just a little bit off. And Yuno's just fucking annoying. He's just fucking perfect, and I fucking can't stand him. But I still like this chapter. I like where Black Clover is going, but it's becoming a series here where the side characters are quickly becoming far more interesting than the main characters. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's move on now to Bleach 627, The Creation. Last chapter, Ichigo and company were getting a lift from video game dude and Ruruka. Who gives a shit? So that they could go and launch a sneak attack on Juhabak, who had fully absorbed the Soul King's power and was using it to recreate the kingdom of the Quincy. And that does it for this week's recap of Bleach.
Yeah, I was like, Nick, you're gonna have to fill in some gaps here, because I kind of fell asleep a lot reading this chapter. Does anything happen besides him building this fucking factory and everyone's like, let's do it?
Nothing happens.
He rebuilt the royal palace into his own.
They arrive. They arrive, and that is it. They try and have this whole thing where, like, fucking what's-his-face is, I'm not gonna leave this goddamn ride once you get we get there. And Gaju's like, why not? Because fuck you guys, that's why. I'm not gonna go out there and die. If you win, great. If we lose, I'll die anyway. But I'm not going to die so that the battle will be won.
And like, I kind of wanted to come out there like, thank God, no one wanted you here anyway.
Just toss him out in the front line, use him as cannon fodder.
Yeah, I'm just like, look, no one was really going to remiss if you died anyway.
And Ichigo, before Ruka can even chip in, just goes, hey, you stay here too. And she's like, hey, I have my own thoughts and motivations. Just because I'm a woman, Ichigo just like talks over her the whole time.
Is he actually out of the line? I'm a woman and I have opinions. He's like, that's great, honey. Why don't you put those knockers to use to put on something slutty like Orihime?
Oh, your boobs are only a normal cup size? Well then, hide your shame, why don't you?
Yeah, he's like, why don't you put on a burka? They're ugly. You're like, I don't
go
remember.
Go and make me a sandwich and fetch me a beer, sweetheart.
Come on, that toots, scat. I'm like, wow, I don't remember Ichigo being this butch of an asshole.
Why don't you? Sweet cakes?
I don't remember Ichigo ever being this much of a douche.
He just, like, fucking says, like, I know that you only like cute things, and that you can only use your power on things that you like. And there's no way you could have liked this stuff. You forced yourself to like it so that you could transport us. That was a huge favor for us. So, stay the fuck here.
Yeah, peace.
Keep the motor running.
He's like, look, we cameoed you in our final arc because we're trying to put everyone into it, but, like, seriously, we have nothing to do with you. So,
and
like,
then they have this attempt to have this moment because Gaju goes, Ichigo, you've really grown up. And he's like, what, really? Have I? And like, nah, I guess you've always been that way. Like, I was about to say, when I first read the line, it's like, really? How is this at all a character change for Ichigo? And he's like, no, you've just always been this way. Great. So this whole character developing scene for Ichigo was to establish his character hasn't changed at all. Great!
I love, to the day I die, I don't know if any series does, like, character moments in worse ways than fucking Bleach. This reminds me so much of that scene, like, fucking Ichigo would never
say things that you don't believe.
yeah. Like, so what, you knew what you were wrong? Why the fuck did you say it? He's just
what's
like,
what's great is that it's the same kind of feeling with Chad, because Ryder Gaju says that Chad and Orihime are just exchanging this knowing glance.
He's just like, I guess you've changed. Actually, I guess you haven't. And everyone just smiles.
Chad,
like,
and Orihime
yeah.
are smiling and are like, yeah, he hasn't.
It's just like, what's the fucking point?
Which is great, because a big point of Bleach has been the fact that Ichigo has had to change his mindset and a lot of stuff in order to get stronger.
Please.
The whole thing was like, in order to get Shikai, he had to, like, have a will to actually fight and kill people. And when he was, like, getting his hollow powers, he had to actually take control of that side of his personality. And when he finally had that final confrontation with Getsuga Tensho, the whole thing was, you have to stop just having a relationship with your sword and just be its conqueror. Even though that negates what we established in the first training. Shut up and go become, like, weird black-haired mummy guy.
Just do
and
it.
That was the end of DSI.
Oh,
Bleach sucks.
All right.
End of the recap.
You want to jump into Devilly Man?
Devilly Man was actually surprising for me, because I actually really liked the idea of it.
I noticed you say the idea of it.
Well, I like the idea of it because I know for certain that there is no way this is going to last very long, because there is no way that this concept can be used to spun into a long-running series. And that's all. That's what my feelings on it. Devilly Man. Zutai.
Thank you.
By Kentaro Fukuda. Chapter 1. Here comes Devilly Man. Start off with the Devilly Man. Madogiwa. There we go. And he introduces himself as a hardworking devil salaryman, which is where we get Devilly Man from. Which I thought was very weird, but I was like, okay, I'll roll with it. Basically, he is in trouble at his job in hell. And so he has to get a billion yen, which is $10 million, to his boss. And as it turns out, the way that devils work in this series is that only evil people can see them when they're going around on Earth, and they can make deals with these people, and whatever power that the devil imparts upon the human, from that point onward, every amount of money that they earn using that power, they have to split 50-50 with the devil. So basically, using this, our devilly man, Madogiwa, has to gather $10 million. So he comes across this one guy and just kind of bumps into him, and the guy gets scared and runs off. But then he's approached by the actual main character of the series, Airu Taira, who is a 7-year-old kid with a stupid hat.
It is maybe the dumbest hat I've seen.
Like, it's like What's-Her-Name's hat in World Trigger, but on a head way too small.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is in that hat? Is his brain in that hat?
Maybe a giant afro. Maybe it's like Kyle from South Park, where if he takes it off, like a giant afro pops out.
And all of the, like, anime-style spiky things are just a decoy.
Yeah. Like, those are just, like, Ted, like, things he tapes on underneath. So he's like, no, this is normal hair.
So, he actually makes a deal with Madogiwa, who, as it turns out, is a really big pushover. And he says, okay, yeah, my power is that when you hold someone's hand, you will be able to see all the bad things that they've done. And so, immediately, the guy catches on. He's like, oh, well, that means that I'll be able to become the greatest blackmailer ever. So, sure, I'll make the deal with you. And Madogiwa's thinking to himself, I'm not sure if I should do this. He is just a little kid and all. This is a new low, even for a devil. Maybe this isn't such a good idea. Yeah, I already signed it. Let's do it. Which, yeah, okay, good. So Taira goes around and he immediately, like, blackmails the cook at the restaurant they ate at, uses that information in order to get to win a free meal and stuff, and just goes around and starts taking people's money. And so basically this kid is made out to basically be, like, Hiruma's younger cousin or some shit.
Mm.
Has no remorse for the actions he takes, becomes the ultimate blackmailer, and so on and so forth. And the plot for the chapter is that the guy that ran into Madogiwa earlier on tricks him into giving up all the money that he got from Taira, and then Taira meets up with him and uses his powers to set up this tremendous, elaborate thing to scare him into giving all of the money back. He blackmails, like, hundreds of people in order to set up this big, elaborate thing and get the money back, and, I guess the rest of the series they're going to work together and try to earn that $10 million that they need to get. And yeah, that's basically it. I really like the concept more than the execution, and more than I think the execution can be, because I really don't think that this can be stretched out very much.
No, I like the devil himself. I think he's kind of like funny and goofy. I hate the kid, though. The kid just annoys me. He's too fucking annoyingly perfect. Like, I'm a super genius at 7 years old, and I'm gonna manipulate all of you guys, and I'm super evil. Like, you know, I get the idea. You know, it's the big devil who's, you know, made a deal with the kid, but the kid's the one in control. He's the real monster here. Like, I get that, you know, concept of the joke. I just don't find him compelling or interesting to follow. It's like trying to follow light, but without any of the, like, hey, we're gonna at least put some moral... kind of moral ambiguity to this or something like that. Like, we're going to put a big plot to this. It's like, nah, he's just an asshole who knows everything. He's going to win. Like, alright, I'm done.
They also do some weird thing where Madogiwa at the end of the chapter is like, by the way, who are you?
Yeah, it's weird. They end the first chapter on a cliffhanger, but I'm like, what? This is a comedy series.
What is he talking about?
Well, he's an annoying kid. I guess it's kind of relevant who he is, but...
It's also weird that Madogiwa doesn't have the power himself. He can only impart it to other people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense, you know, sell your soul to the devil for powers, but, yeah. Want to jump into 2 weeks worth of Fairy Tale?
Did this week's come out as well?
No, this week hasn't come out, but it's still 2 chapters of Fairy Tale.
Right, okay.
So this is the end of our 2-chapter-a-week deluge of Fairy Tale, and also the end, essentially, of this arc. Starting with chapter 435, Cry of Victory. So, last time, Natsu beat the giant giant thing, who was one of the 18 super giants of whatever, and there's a image here of Natsu Dragon Eyes. I don't get what that is. That looks like fan art. I don't know why it's included in this. Maybe it is an official image, but you know, whatever. Anyway, Natsu beat him, and now he's going to look all super strong, and everyone within the guild's like, how are we defeated? And then they realize there were two members of the guild that didn't even show fighting, and they just get fucking thwomped and beaten when Gajeel, Pantheliller, and, I always forget, Levy show up, and Lucy sees them and is like, oh, you know, your rumors are right, you really did sign on to the council, and you know, Levy's like, oh, weren't you a reporter?
I do like the exchange that people keep having with Gajeel. Because, like, no one believes that Gajeel joined the councilmen.
Yeah, like, he shows up and, Natsu's
you must
like,
be Gajeel's twin brother.
Yeah, and Gajeel's, Natsu's like, hey, what's up, Mr. Dead Ringer for Gajeel? And he's like, what are you talking about? And I actually like it because Gajeel explains, he's like, yeah, you know, I originally came across this when it was the tree guy's idea, and they cut over to Wabard, and he's like, it was just a joke. And Gajeel's actually like, yeah, now I outrank you guys, so you're all under arrest because I don't like your eyes, and Lucy's a pervert, and Juvia's charged with criminal drenching, and Happy eats too many fish, and I just don't like you, Whitney, so you're arrested too. He's just an asshole. I just don't like you.
It hits him in the back of the head. It's like, I don't know who you are, but you look just like Gajeel, so stop it.
Yeah, Urza has to fucking show up and ruin the fun. But Pantheliller is like, no, that actually is Gajeel. And they explain, we're the ones who have been trying to stop Operation Purify. The S&M guy from before has apparently been defeated and tied up on his own bondage equipment. And Gray left a message to kind of let them know where to go. And now, basically, everyone's teamed up. You know, they're, where's Az? Like, now we have attained our triumph. This merits a cry of victory. And I want her to, from now on, like, just be Thor. Like, just, like, the stupidest, like, warrior. Like, verily, friends, she shall hold her arms up in victory pose. Like, just fucking stupid.
Now I can draw Lucy's underboob.
It's such a stupid line. Now we have attained our triumph. This merits a cry of victory. Like, what an odd, like, form of syntax to use for what you're like, hey, everybody, high five!
Urza was going to spend the previous year training, but then she realized she just had to dig into her closet and find new suits of armor, so instead she just worked on her speech presentation.
Yeah, she's just like, hey, I can seem more epic if I just change the way the words are. So yeah, there's a 2-page spread of everyone in Fairy Tail, well, the important characters of Fairy Tail, I guess, all posing with their arms raised. You get a lot of Lucy underboob, you get a precariously short skirt from Wendy, Carla jumps into the frame, yeah, I guess this is supposed to be like, hey, the time skips, kind of wrapped up in our groups back together, at least as much as they're going to be. We'll probably just add everyone else in later without any big introduction. Like, this is, the end of the transition. So let's all be super happy about it. And then it cuts away to Sting and Rogue, who are looking on outside. And Sting's like, hey, isn't this great? You know, we can't compete with that. And Lecter. Lecter's like, hey, yeah, they're really strong. Don't you think so, Frosch? And everyone's like, oh, where's Frosch? And then suddenly we see Frosch is hanging out with the rest of the cats, and Gray sees him. He's like, hey, you're that Frosch cat, aren't you? Frosch thinks so, too!
God damn it!
And then Gray's like, what are you doing here? What is Frosch doing here? Like, even he's the way he's like, why am I here?
I just saw people happy. I was like, I'll be over here too.
And then Gray
stops being Nick's favorite character.
Yeah, Gray suddenly is like, it's so weird because I guess like the way it came in my mind, I was like, oh, they attained this to be like the dramatic moment of like, oh wait, Gray's supposed to kill him. Like what's going to happen? Like, is there something insidious about to go on? But it's like within the same page, he's like, you're super duper cute. Yeah, all my worries are fading away. And he smiles and fucking hugs the fucking cat. And yeah, everyone's just like, what are you doing? He's just like, Frosch is so cute. I just can't help it. And, Luvia's annoyed because, it's another rival for Gray's affection. And there's a shot of Gray being like, ha ha ha, I love this thing. And everyone reacting. And Luvia's pissed off. And Urza, I think, has just seen Christ for the first time. She's got the weirdest expression on her face. Like, she's never fucking seen a cat before. She's like, that cat's wearing a frog suit. And it's talking. what assistant drew this? Like,
well, then Urza kind of, like, slowly turns around and looks at Carla and Happy and the others. Just like, wait a minute. All the cast have been talking this whole time.
She's like, holy shit, I just hit my high. I've smoked, like, 6 pounds right before the fight. It's all hitting me. Holy shit, guys, all the cats are talking. And that one's 8 feet tall. I don't know, like, who drew it? Like, what is that expression supposed to convey? Her eye is enormous.
What the fuck is with Khajiit's teeth?
Yeah, he's just like, hey, I'm gonna eat that cat.
That cat looks super tasty. He eats Broche, and Sting instead becomes evil because of him. The thing that I observed, which I guess is the thing we're supposed to take from this, I don't know if you could do the same thing, but we see Sting, his shadow, and it's dark in the first panel we see it, but then it becomes lighter in the second panel, which means his dark future is now officially gone, because Gray saw Frosch and was like, no, I don't want to kill him, he's cute.
I won't kill this
thing. It was that easy.
I do not get what the fuck future happened. Like, what parallel happened where Gray killed Frosch? What happened? Like, is there a parallel reality where Frosch walked in and, like, accidentally tripped and, like, a barrel of knives flew into Juvia and just speared her to death?
Gray just comes home one day and finds Frosch fucking Juvia over the table.
Yeah, he's just banging her. He's just like, I didn't think you'd be... Frosch didn't think you'd be home so soon!
And he's just talking in third person through the whole thing, and it's that that pisses Gray off. Not the fact that they're funny, but the fact that they're super into
it. He's like, I had so much of this with Marv Gear, I am not putting up with it again! Just breaks Frosch's neck.
The threesome. Third-person threesome.
He's like, I don't know how many people are involved in this anymore. I'm stopping it now. It just breaks both of their necks.
By the writers who brought you World Sugar to my heart, back door.
I don't get this reality, though. Because even in this timeline, Gray was not evil.
It was going to happen.
What?
Shadow's dark. It was going to happen. And then when they hugged, it stopped going to happen.
Gray's like, if this thing hadn't fucking said its own name, I wanted to crush it, because I hate frogs. But I realized it was kind of cute then. He wasn't evil! What was supposed to happen?
I don't know! It's like, this is not how alternate realities work! So, like, because Evil Sting came back in time, suddenly the possibility started to exist. And in fact, that was what was going to happen now. That was the road that we were going to be on. But then, as soon as Sting saw them hugging, he was like, oh, I guess that's not going to happen. Sting did not even know it was going to happen. He didn't know, because Nazar didn't tell him.
Oh man, Rachel's dumb.
I fucking love it. Chapter 436!
Chapter 436, Memoirs, and our cover is Zeref.
This one was completely the opposite. This chapter was fucking great!
Yeah, you're like, shit happens in this chapter! Franchise's biggest problem is so many arcs happen with no fucking consequence. There's this long ongoing plot of Acknowledgia and Zeref and all this shit and never gets addressed, and you're like, oh, here's a chapter to actually progress the plot forward. It's like, hey, we'll do an arc for 30 chapters, and at the end of it, we'll move the actual plot forward one step.
This chapter did more for the long-running plot of Fairy Tail than the entire time we have been recapping it together times infinity.
I was going to say, like, the past 4 years of Fairy Tail have not progressed the plot forward as much as this one chapter. So, this is a flashback, as you mentioned, for Zeref, back to presumably a very, very long time ago, where in the world there was the Meliden Academy of Magic, where Zeref was a very young child who was incredibly gifted, but most people really didn't take much of an interest in studies because they're like, look, you're really young, and you're looking, you know, your subject matter is about life and death, and it's, you know, it has to be treated delicately, you know, you really can't take your you know, your research into much consideration because of that. And Zeref's like, oh, was it a dream? That was a very strange dream, Natsu. I had a younger brother who passed away a few years after he was born.
He's saying this out loud.
Yeah, to nobody. No one. Yeah, he's just talking.
It's so great.
I just couldn't, like, he's like, huh, people don't know about my backstory, I suppose. Well, I had a younger brother. He passed away only a because you're about to see in the flashback I reference a brother, so I need to let you know now he's dead. But, oh, I just couldn't accept it. And, you know, we go back into the flashback, and he's talking about how he theoretically has some plan to basically create the R system, which is going to be used to bring people back from the dead, to revive people. And everyone's like, wow, this is incredible. He's such a young kid. And I don't know if we actually find out this guy's name or what his position is, but it's basically one of the teachers at this academy. He's like,
and it's implied he has a close relationship with Zeref.
Yeah, he's like, look, I need to tell you again, it's forbidden to try to attempt to raise the dead. What you're doing is messing with the cycle of life and death. It's, you know, it's playing God. You can't do this. It's not your place. You know, Zeref's like, but there is a place for man's free will to be involved in a man's life, isn't there? And if so, considering that death is where life is leading, he's like, no, stop it! I beg you to Ankh Salem, which I guess is the god of life and death in this world, look upon this child, grant him your mercy and protection. And, you know, he talks about, like, oh, I stop working on this plan of yours. And basically, it all comes down to Zeref has this younger brother, and he's working so diligently on this plan of his for his younger brother, but he won't outright say it. He's just, you know, I need to work on it to revive people. And this teacher basically, like, comes in, you know, makes him know that, like, look, I know why you're doing this, but you have to stop. And he's like, oh, this is for the greatest people. He's like, it won't bring your brother back. And saying that seems to just cause something to snap in Zeref. And this, I don't know if it's a portal or just horrifying energy just radiates off of Zeref. All the plants in the area start dying. You know, he's like, Dean, you know, what's going on here? And his power kills everybody in the academy. This is the Zeref we've come to know, that he just radiates this aura that just kills things. And, you know, he says, when I came to, everyone in the academy, teachers and students alike were dead. Perhaps I did anger the god Ankh Salem, and he cast a curse of contradiction on me. The more and more I wished to preserve life, the more I stole life from that which was around me. To alleviate the curse, I had to curb my desire to preserve life, and I myself became immortal. And, you know, he suffered all this guilt for what he did, but because he was alive all this time, he could continue his research, and, you know, it became this very complicated life full of contradictions, because he wants to wish for death, but at the same time he wants to continue his research, and he's creating these life forms that should have the power to kill him, but they haven't been able to yet. But, as we found out before, he has created one more that is his, you know, his trump card, that is End, and as we found out before, that is Atherius Natsu Dragnil. And we see that Natsu, presumably our Natsu, though it could, I suppose, just as easily be a clone or something else, our Natsu is that he is a clone of Zeref's younger brother, who was grown in a lab, and presumably he's the one that will kill him one day, or what Zeref hopes will kill him.
He says specifically that Natsu's body was originally Zeref's brother's body, and so he basically gave him the power to kill him, essentially.
Yes.
So, Zeref and Natsu technically are brothers, sort of.
Yes,
and he's also sort of his father.
So. Yeah, and he's talking to the book, it looks like, the Book of End, because he says, like, let us save the circumstances that brought you to Yggdrasil and my relationship with Mavis for our next chance to chat. I have an appointment with a person today, if you can call that a person.
And that's not the end! Yes. More happens!
He walks away, and then he meets with a man, a very strange man with dark skin and a tribal, you know, kind of tattoos on him and, like, a, you know, tooth necklace. And he's like, so that's the form you're most comfortable in? Is your arm hearing well? Acnologia! Dun, dun, dun! We get a two-page spread of Acnologia, where he says, like, what do you want? And, basically, the two of them just have, like, kind of one of those tense chats of, like, I could kill you.
I could kill you.
Well, do it.
No, you do it.
No, you
first.
Well, they also mention, like, you know, Zeref says, you know, I've been wondering, you know, maybe I should side with the humans and fight against you, or maybe I should side with you and fight against the humans. But, nah, I'm just going to kill you both. That's all there is to it.
Yeah. They're both somewhat sides of the exact same coin, because Acnologia, from all we've known of him, is this dragon of destruction who goes around and just obliterates things. That seems to be the only thing he exists for. And Xerath's sole goal is to kind of go around and extinguish all life. That's pretty much all he exists for either. But, you know, two forces of that nature don't actually want to cooperate. They're both like, no, I want to kill you first. And it seems like there's about to be a conflict between them, because Xerath says, like, how about me? Just wait. The final battle is coming between human, dragon, and immortal. And that's the end of the chapter.
I really fucking dug this.
The second chapter, as you said, the second chapter was actually really good, because it is pushing forward the plot of the series, which is something that desperately needs, because we've been so long of just repeating the same cycle. Here's a villain group, here's a generic boss for them to fight, everybody fights them, they look like they're going to lose for a second, no wait, no, they beat everybody, rinse and repeat for, you know, 50 chapters. When you actually start pushing along the plot of Xerath and Acnologia and all this stuff, you're like, oh, there's more interesting stuff going on here, and it's a lot more compelling, so I'm you know, obviously interested to see this. These are characters who have been built up throughout the course of the series, so you have a lot more invested in them. You know, this isn't like Hades or fucking Bran or any of Brain, whatever the fuck the guy of Orsion 6 was. Like, these are characters who I'm like, okay, even if they just get clowned by Natsu, which I'm certain they will, there's at least interest built into these ones that I'm invested in. You know, this has been built up over a long period of time. I want to see the payoff. And they're, you know, they seem cool.
Yeah, and on top of that, the story itself is pretty cool, I think. So,
they served their purpose well. So
the first chapter was fucking stupid.
Oh yeah, the first chapter was goofy, but
the second chapter was fucking great.
Yeah. So I guess for the first
overall 5 out of 10.
So I think for the first time, we finally saw the advantage of having 2 chapters a week for Fairy Tail.
Yeah, we get the best of both worlds, kind of. Okay, yeah, I guess let's move on to Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma. As it turns out, we are completely correct. The first seat is that plain-looking guy. As all the positions of the Council of Ten are immediately laid out at the start of this chapter. I'm not going to bother going through all of them, but we get mostly some introduction to Eishi Tsukasa, who is the first seat. And so he mentions to Soma, as well as Aldini, his Italian cooking friend, and Subaru, who did the Shokugekis with both of them. I was like, you know, I wish you hadn't done those Shokugeki. And he just gets all complainy and timid and is tracing the stuff on the ground and stuff. He's like, I had to... you guys kept on doing Shokugekis, and I had to do all this paperwork, and I was so busy.
I love this character after one, like, 3 pages, because it starts off like he's, you know, he's in this pose, his tie, you know, his tie's over his shoulder, he looks so, you know, confident, like, and drinking tea, as we see all the other characters, and like, you know, he's calling everybody by name, he has such a glance, during the fall classic, and then, like, it shows, like, wind blowing, like, this is going to be an ominous moment, he's like, well, I really wish you guys hadn't done that Shokugeki.
So everyone just like, come on, man, pull yourself together. And Yu-Gi-Oh! Guy, whose name is Teru Nori Kuga.
Let's just call him Yu-Gi-Oh!
Kugayo or some shit like that. Kuga says, he's in spineless mode again, which, I mean, of course, indicates this happens all the fucking time. And he is the most talkative by far out of the whole group, as he was in the last chapter. And so he kind of, he says, Soma actually mentions to him, is like, you know, if you guys are worried about giving up your seats, you don't have to do that. We can just do a Shokugeki for something else. And he's like, you just don't get it. Okay, look, let me explain what being on the council really means. And he indicates that essentially, if you're on the Council of Ten, you get access to Tosugi Academy's ridiculously vast resources. And so long as you are doing something for the sake of your cooking, you can spend basically as much money as you want. If you want a ridiculously old recipe that is incredibly difficult to find, they'll find it for you. If you want a very specific cookbook that would go for a ridiculous amount on the market, then they'll get it for you. You can use anything that they have access to, and so on and so forth. And on top of that, if you have an even higher seat, you get even more special privileges. So not only is being, you know, on the Council of Ten, does that mean that, you know, if you are just one of the best, it also means that you get to evolve further and do a whole lot more. And they actually sum this up with Tsukasa saying this very poetic thing, which is, life is short, but the sprawling wasteland that is cooking is wide and vast. Even if you commit your whole life to it, it's impossible to walk across it all, but becoming part of the council lets you pick up your pace considerably. Which is a really cool way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, he sums up by holding up by saying, you know, the best and brightest are the Totsuki Institute Council of 10 Masters, and between the Council of 10 and a regular chef, there lies an unbelievable gap in sheer power, which is symbolized with the Council of 10 up on this tremendous peak, and some way below them. So.
A very cool image, I might add.
Shokeki no Sama is nothing if not full of cool images. Mm-hmm. And Kuga is like, you guys aren't even a fucking blip on our radar, are you? So go back to the kiddie pool, play around with your little friends, and so on and so forth. But if you had one thing, just one, that you could beat me at in cooking, I wouldn't mind taking you up on a shokugeki. But that's just not possible. So that's kind of the note that they leave on, because they just leave.
Yeah, like, later.
Bye. We got important stuff to do. So Megumi kind of watches them go, and then she turns back to all the other first-year students, and almost all of them are super fired up, like someone's not on the panel, and Megumi's looking at them in shock, and Aaron is looking at them like, come on, guys, seriously.
Together, come on.
I love her inclusion in that panel, because she's like, what the fuck ever. So they go off to handle their own business. The Council of Ten is super busy. And so Megumi and Soma head back from the meeting, and they're kind of chatting as they go on their way. And Megumi actually kind of sides a little bit with Soma, saying, you know, I don't like that they kind of look down on you because you're such a good cook, and it's not like I like you or anything. Don't think that!
Didn't she even say, like, you're a really good cook, you know? I'm not like... Yeah, because she's like, but unlike me, you're a really, really good chef. He's like, yeah, thanks!
Well, like, I think he's just gotten used to her having no self-esteem.
Yeah. That was like
there's idea, only like, so many times you can get to know someone over the course of... You can talk with someone over the course of 6 months if they're constantly getting down on themselves, or you can say, don't be hard on yourself.
Yeah, just like, you really beat yourself up a lot. Like, she's like, oh man, you're really good unlike me. Yep, thanks. I am awesome, aren't I?
She's gotten more confident.
Well, yeah. So.
I think that he's just at the point where it's like, well, this
is... He's like, I'm tired of...
It's not like she's hiding behind her bike while she's saying this. So.
I'm tired of babysitting your ego.
So they come across this fucking dump truck, basically, full of rocks. And so they're like, what the hell is going on? And Megumi says, oh, it's the Institute's last major event of the fall. The Totsuki Institute School Festival. And so we're like, there's gonna be a school festival! Gleam!
Chapter end.
I'm getting actually kind of worried that Shokugeki no Sama is going to be nothing but special events. Because at the start of the series, they would just kind of go through classes and stuff, and someone would occasionally, you know, have to take someone on in a competition or something like that. There didn't have to be a big special event every goddamn time that they wanted to do something. It's weird that they're just jumping from event to event to event.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand why they're doing it, but it is, like, not frustrating, but it is like, it's getting a little bit repetitive. I've only been reading this series for, you know, 6 months or whatever, and we're already, like, at the idea of, like, oh, another tournament festival of some kind?
Yeah, because they had the whole tournament thing, which lasted a long time. Then they immediately went on Stagiaire, which lasted a month, and then right after they did that, they went to go, you know, have the meetup with the Council of Ten, and now apparently they're already getting ready for this festival. It's like, do you kids ever attend class anymore?
They're like, yeah, we attend class so we can learn things to use at school festivals.
Oh, so yeah.
Well, fair enough.
Even Yu-Gi-Oh! GX showed the classroom sometimes.
What I do like, though, I like that maybe it could have been given a little more focus, and I'm sure we'll get more focus as we kind of see them, because, you know, Shokugeki no Sama has been very good with its side plot. But I like at least that in that moment of, hey, here's the council, you know, this main guy's talking to them, they're going to basically set up, like, hey, Sama, you know, you're really making a big deal, but, you know, you're fucking insignificant to us, like, you're so far between us. How it fires him up.
Wait, you've got a long way to go.
Yeah, it fires him up, but it fires almost everyone else up in the class. You know, Aaron is like, I'm already part of the council, so I'm really care. And no, Megumi's like, oh, I'm golly willikers, I can't cook.
Gee willikers!
But the rest of them are like, oh, we want to fucking get on that council too. Like, we want to show you guys. Like, I like the idea that the rest of them are all motivated as well, and hopefully this is going to spur them forward. I guess we'll have to see how the context of this school festival is. Maybe it'll be more, maybe it'll be different than just like a tournament with the random ingredients. But, you know, even then, I still like it. As long as
your secret ingredient is
Nutella on the go.
Okay, next time that we do it, Frickin' Shigeki, we gotta remember to do the Iron Chef voices.
Only if we do Japanese Iron Chef, so it could just be racist.
Well, they also did that stuff in Iron Chef America.
Yeah, it was. Well, because they was like, I am the chairman's son. Fucking, like, you know, our secret...
No, you're not.
Our secret ingredient is... Fish butts!
Fish butts!
It's, there's always some asshole on the show who's like, I'm gonna make fish butt ice cream. Like, god damn it. Every week that ice cream machine got fucking used and no ingredients ever. Chocolate was never the time when it happened.
Okay, let's move on to My Hero Academia. Number 43, Todoroki versus Bakugo.
Mm-hmm.
Which is Todoroki versus Bakugo.
I didn't quite get the chapter title.
Todoroki versus Bakugo. So they fight. And Todoroki unleashes a big old wave of ice, and Bakugo is just like, I'm gonna just blow through this wall of ice and bust through it and go through the hole I make. And he does that, and he grabs Todoroki and tries to throw him out. So, Bakugo basically has anticipated this, and he's, you know, thinking to himself, his quirk is really powerful, so he doesn't have incredible control over it, so it'll be easier to dodge stuff. But they go back and forth a little bit. Todoroki catches himself from getting a ring out by summoning a wave of ice behind him, launching himself back. Bakugo tries to jump in and hit him with another blast, but Todoroki grabs his arm and avoids it. I'm not sure exactly what happens after that. I think that Bakugo somehow just blasts himself backwards in order to get away. And at that point, Bakugo does sort of his version of what Deku did in his match against Todoroki. And he's like, come on, you know, am I not good enough for you to use your fire side and stuff? And the announcers are analyzing Todoroki and saying, you know, his attacks are lacking. You know, he has lost his drive since this fight against Midoriya. So Bakugo is interpreting this as Todoroki just trying to make a fool out of him. And he charges back in and he's like, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to take the first to end all first. But there's no point in winning against some half-ass punk. No point if I can't do better than Deku! Which is actually a weird acknowledgement from him. And also, I like the detail that when he says after that, if you're not trying to win, get the hell out of my face, and it cuts to Uraraka. Because
he respected her.
Yeah. So it's like, nice little detail. He's probably not actually talking about her, but nice little detail.
Yeah.
And Pete goes on saying, why are you even here, you bastard? And Todoroki just thinks to himself, it's because I want to be a hero, so I'm sorry, but since I fought with Midoriya, I just don't know what I should do, whether or not what I'm doing is right. In the moment, in that instant, I forgot all about you, referring to his dad. I'm not sure about anything anymore. Deku screams to him not to lose from the stands, and Bakugo's like, yeah, fight me, fight to win, come at me with everything you've got. He launches an explosion at Todoroki. It looks like Todoroki's going to actually use his fire powers. And then he remembers his confrontation with Endeavor, and the fire disappears. He uses his ice to shield himself as Bakugo unleashes Howitzer Impact, his biggest move, blasts Todoroki backwards, and the announcer analyzes, oh, Todoroki doesn't seem to have fired off that heat blast he showed us when fighting Midoriya. In the end, he... And Bakugo's, you know, sees Todoroki, and he kind of like, he's already on the ground because he let out everything he had in the attack, and he thinks to himself, he snuffed out his flames. And Todoroki is sure enough lying in a heap on top of a whole bunch of ice that he summoned, I guess, to help shield against the impact, or maybe it was already behind him. And he's gotten ringed out, and Bakugo gets right up, runs over to him, grabs him by the collar, and says, stop messing around! And he's like, he's going to punch him again anyway. But in a rather actually sad moment, he goes, not like this! Not like... And then he collapses because he's out of stamina as well. But Todoroki gathering first, so Bakugo wins, and he is declared the winner of the first year UA Sports Festival. So, Bakugo won.
Did you expect this, Nick?
I actually did.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I was pretty sure Bakugo was going to win because he kept on, you know, losing seemingly every test before this. So,
it was very interesting, man. It's definitely a daring move because you are giving this tournament to... Yeah, obviously, he didn't put Deku as the winner. He lost in the second round. And you're doing the same with Todoroki, who would essentially be our surrogate protagonist right now, because he is the most compelling character outside of this. He's the one with the most sympathetic backstory. He's the one who Midorikawa put everything on the line to basically try to spur forward to be a hero. So he would be our...
And Bako was basically the antagonist of the tournament. He beat Uraraka, he beat the Shadow Guy, and now he's beating Todoroki.
Yeah, so... By having him be the victor, you're playing for a long payoff here. This is a long burn, and I love those. It's risky to do it because I wonder what the reaction to this is going to be. I mean, I don't think it'll be too bad because a lot of people just like Bakugo because like he's super cool and cute and awesome and all that. But it is definitely like, okay, you're going somewhere with this. You're showing us not only do you have plans for Deku, but you have long-term plans for Todoroki. You didn't just pay off his character development here because he didn't grow from this yet. He's changed, but he has not grown. He's making that change.
Yeah, he was... It's established. He could have probably won if he used his fire powers, but...
He doesn't know what he wants to do with them yet.
Yeah, he used them against Midoriya because it was just a spur-of-the-moment thing, and he is now at a crossroads still. It looked like maybe he had gotten past that when he fought Deku. We learned this time. No. He's just kind of in chaos in his mind. And as for how it affects Bakugo, I actually would argue that this is kind of a necessary thing for him. Mm-hmm. Because, like I said, he kept on being made a fool of. Deku rescued him to start the series. He, you know, kept on losing in the tests. And this establishes him as one of the strongest members of their year and actually makes him a worthwhile rival to Deku, which is, you know, what they've been through the whole series. You know, Deku thinks they're friends, but they're rivals. And you can't have a strong rival figure without letting them fucking win.
And they keep losing all the time. Yeah, I like it for that aspect. I think we're in for a long burn with Bakugo as well. And it's a sad loss for him. Like, it's not even, like, a, you know, admirable, because he's just, like, he's bitching the entire way down. Like, not like this, asshole. You're supposed to go all out. All the fights I've had, I've gone against tough opponents, and you're the one who's going to go out not giving it his all. Like, my final match. It's like having great games all the way up into the Super Bowl, and then your opponent fucking just lays a steaming turkey, and you just run all over them. You're like,
God damn it, Denver!
Yeah, you're like, God, Peyton fucking botched the snap, fucking safety is ridiculous. But it is just like, you know, it's underwhelming. You're like, come on, man. I wanted a great finale. You're supposed to be this big, strong hero, and you're not going to go all out on me. This doesn't make me feel like I'm the strongest.
And it's actually because we saw all of Bakugo's matches to some extent, we know, yeah, he actually did have great, awesome matches with those others. Uraraka went all out and did some clever stuff, but ultimately lost. He had to be really clever in order to beat his other two opponents. And it was established that he was actually a lot more clever than he appeared to be in, you know, previous outings. And then it's just like, okay, I'm going to go out and fight this guy. And he didn't go all out against me. So what the fuck does my victory even mean?
Yeah, it doesn't even mean anything, you know. So very, very cool chapter. It's again, I think I mentioned it when we were talking about Black Clover earlier. But this is definitely more... intricate and complicated writing than we tend to get in Jump series recently. So I'm all for it.
Digging it. Let's move on to Naruto, the Seventh Hokage and the Scarlet Spring. Number 700 plus 4, Chance Meeting, (2). So last time, Naruto showed up in the nick of time to help protect Sarada and Chocho from the mysterious Shin. And so they have a stare-off, Naruto and Shin do, and Shin reveals he's got the Mangekyo Sharingan with those stupid giant frickin' eyeball pupil things. He tries to attack Naruto with a really weird multi-pronged shuriken attack thing, but Kurama just, like, his arms just lash out and grab all of them and block them, And, you know, Kurama's talking with Naruto and saying, oh, we gotta let loose for once. And Naruto says, just a little bit, as he summons his Biju form. And, so Shin basically runs away, while Chocho is like, oh my god, the 7th Hokage is so awesome! And, at that moment, a little eyeball thingy pops up next to Shin and says, you have to retreat. You cannot defeat him by yourself. And, they quickly teleport away with, something that actually looks very similar to Tobi's, or Obito, I guess, his dimensional shifting powers. And they just immediately leave. Okay, this is kind of funny. So, they recover, and Chocho goes up to Naruto and is like, could you be my real papa?
He's like, what happened to Choji? Like, he's just like, from the beginning, he's just like, what happened to Choji? Like, he even mentions, he's like, what, isn't Choji still around? Like, what's going on?
It's like, the journey was all about uncovering the truth, but am I like a fair maiden who everyone's fighting over? What do I do? And I was like, what's going on?
Yeah, he's like, no one wanted you, so,
And he's just like, hey, I think that Serato was actually the one he wanted, not you, Chocho. You're not special. Shut up.
He's just created John Locke. She's just going to run around and be like, I can be special! Not everyone's meant to be special. Don't tell me what I can't do!
So Serato, you know, gets all worried and freaked out. She's like, who are they? And why are they after me? And so Naruto just lays a hand on her head. And he's like, you know, don't worry about it. You know, I'll protect you and I'll take care of this. And, you know, gives her this reassuring grin. And Serato starts to blush. And it's this really, really weird series of pages because, not weird, I guess, but kind of, it actually kind of hits me a little bit because he's just being nice to her and being protective and reliable like her dad never was.
He actually does have a moment where you're like, oh, like, is he like, because he really does treat her like it's one of his child, and you do realize, like, he's the Hokage, so yeah. All of them are his children, you know, he's protecting the village the same way the 3rd Hokage looked over all of the...
It's nice to see Naruto being a good Hokage.
Yeah, and you see it, you're just like, oh, okay, and then you remember, like, man, Sasuke really doesn't give a fuck about you. Now, as we'll get to the end, maybe there are reasons for that, but I do especially like that, you know, she gives him her bento, the bento that, you know, Anatomate, and he immediately has a recollection to when Sasuke and Sakura both offered him their bentos during the team exam, and you know it's both of them are within her. Like, oh, you know, you have both traits of them in you.
Yeah, it's cool.
It's a really nice, like, look. I know we like to poop on Naruto for whatever reasons, but Naruto in this series has been just phenomenal. You're like, wow, what a great fucking dude. Like,
yeah.
He's great. He's just fantastic.
So, you know, they eat the bento, and that's where I was like, hey, could you tell me, you know, what kind of person my dad is? And Naruto's like, oh, well, let's see. He was always quite popular with the girls at the academy. Just like me. And he was really handsome. Just like me. Plus, he always took the top grade in ninjutsu, hands down. Like me. But, and so Chocho's immediately like, is there only one top score?
That sounds weird.
But then Naruto says, but he was surly, antisocial, self-righteous, and rude, which was not like me at all.
And that sort of bums her out, because she's so happy to hear about how awesome her dad was, and then he's like, oh, saying mean things. And then he shortens up and being like, yeah, but he's my rival, and that's true even now.
And so that kind of... She's not really happy to hear that, but it catches her attention, and he says, you know, watching you earlier reminded me a lot of Sasuke and Sakura from back then. You know, Sasuke doesn't wear glasses, but otherwise he looks just like you, especially around their eyes, and, but your overall feel somehow reminds me of Sakura, like how you might be scary when you're really mad, and so I was like, aww, because, like, I am like my parents.
Aww. Yeah, and that's, this is actually a very key scene for, I think, what the theme of the story is going to be. It was noted before that Naruto had those scenes with his parents around the time that Kishimoto himself became a father. And I can't help but look at this as another similar story to him playing to his views of parenting at this point, having a child. Because there's a story, there's a lot of theories going around Sarada is a clone, or Sarada is some kind of, you know, weird orphan creation or something like that. And this scene is very firmly establishing what the point of it's going to be, is it doesn't matter where you came from, this is your family and these are your parents because you are like them. You know, you have their traits, you have what carries them, even if you may not look like them, even if you may have differences in them, you know, they're your family, and you're carrying their best qualities within you.
Yeah.
And it's a very sweet sentiment.
You also see that he's kind of doing the same thing with JoJo, but it's really short. It's like, your face is just like Karui's, but your physique is just like Joji's as a kid.
Yeah.
Joji's your real dad. Karui's your real mom.
Get the fuck back to town.
So we get a bit of montage. It's clear they're traveling together to go and find Sasuke. And then when they stop to rest, let's see, Sarai excuses herself saying she needs to use the bathroom. But instead, she runs off on her own because they're really close to reaching Sasuke. And so she imagines, like, I'm going to finally get to meet him. I'll get to see him. And she imagines herself, you know, hugging him. And she starts to tear up. She's like, I'm going to find Dad. And she gets to the tower. Sasuke is there. And he kind of gets the drop on her. And she starts to tear up. She's like, oh, Dad. And then he goes, how did you find me? Are you one of them? And he draws his sword and holds it towards her. And she's just, you know, confused. And that's where the chapter ends.
It's also worth noting that as she's jumping out to go visit him, her Sharingan activate.
Yeah.
Which I think is something they had noted she hadn't had to this point. So.
Right, because Naruto specifically says, your eyes will probably look more like his once you do develop the Sharingan.
Yeah, so they...
But when you think about it, you know, she's experiencing very strong emotions, because, mm-hmm. not for negative reasons, but for positive reasons.
Yeah, well, unsure reasons for her at this point. She really doesn't know what to expect from her dad, and things don't go very well from this first meeting. But it is curious to see where this goes.
The important detail is that her Sharingan kicks in, so I guess that's why Sasuke's suspicious of her, as opposed to, who the fuck are you? Which would probably be what he says... given that he does not recognize her in the slightest. Either it's been a fucking long time since he saw her, or he's never met her in his life.
Or he's just like, I had a kid? What are you talking about?
Oh, God, I guess if you put your dick in that many women.
Oh, man, I'm busy plowing half the women of fucking Konoha, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I gotta get the Uchiha clan back up and running, you know.
You shut the fuck up! Stop reading fan fiction and thinking it's real.
No, I gotta, you know, I'm gonna repopulate the Earth.
It's just Sasuke actually writing that fan fiction.
it's just like, that's what he's been doing this whole time. He's just he's like in a room with like an 8 gallon Mountain Dew that just leads into his mouth and a fucking fan fiction account open. Like, whoa.
He's reached the highest form of the Sharingan.
No, I'm tracking down ninjas on MySpace.
On Craigslist.
No, nothing's here. Everything's safe on this Bandcamp page. You go away.
I really like this chapter of Naruto, though. It was one of those things where it's like it really built you up, and it looked like it was going to have, it kind of filled you with happy feelings, and then it suddenly came crashing down, you know, when you saw the whole thing from Sarada's perspective. So, good stuff.
Absolutely.
I'm liking this way more than the last arc of Naruto.
Mm-hmm. This has been very good.
One Piece, chapter 787, 4 minutes before. Last time, Sabo had intercepted Burgess in order to help buy time for Luffy to get away. And so he says, I'm Sabo the Revolutionary, and Luffy's my brother, so what do you want with them? And Sabo kind of reestablishes stuff that we already know, but not a lot of people within the series know. You know, your crew took Ace with prisoner, and that started this paramount war. That was the life Ace chose, and I won't blame you for what happened. But from now on, I've got Luffy's back, so keep that in mind. So, presumably, Sabo's saying, I will be showing up beyond this first chapter, this first story arc, yeah. So Burgess is like, yeah, whatever, I've got no quarrel with the revolutionaries. And Sabo says, well, how about personally? And he shows off the flame fruit, and he's like, ah, you're the Lucy that beat me that time. He's like, yep. So, he kind of runs with, tells Gats, you know, go ahead, and I'll have my hands full with Burgess. And Luffy's like, it's okay. Cats and the others will buy me some time. It's Gats. And don't worry, Doflamingo's mine. I love whenever Luffy just fucking ignores people.
He's like, whatever, Cats.
So Burgess and Sabo start to fight. He tries to just lariat straight through Sabo, and well, he's a flame man, so no effect.
Yeah, it was weird that he didn't go with Hawking. Jesus is a
Burgess
fucking
is not
dumbass.
Smart.
He's a fucking dumbass.
So Sabo launches this really ridiculous attack, which seems to indicate that he is probably some connection with Dragon probably having trained him, because he refers to it as a Dragon Claw Fist. So it seems to be like his fighting style. Of course, he augments it with Flame Fruit, but this was not something that Ace used. So I was like, so you've got your set sights in on me, huh? Well, I guess the rumors were correct that you're hunting power users, which plays off of the idea that we mentioned last week, or you mentioned last week, I guess. Let's see. And Luffy basically explains, but you were Lucy and won the Flame Fingers. No, that wasn't me in the final. Okay. Anyway, your recovery is the only hope for Dressrosa. And Doflamingo has gone a little crazy. He has killed basically everyone who has gone after him, and has summoned up giant fucking tentacles from the ground as part of his string powers, and he tells them, I don't need any stamina to eliminate you fucking miserable rats, so get out here, Straw Hat, you're gonna rue this mistake! And everyone is panicking, trying to get away if they're not fighting with him. And then they come across people who are running away from the birdcage. They're like, why are you running the other way? Well, we're heading for the town center. But that's a battlefield! Oh, God, we've got nowhere to go! And so, basically, things are just getting amped up. Time is running out. Zoro has, told everyone, like, okay, I'm gonna see if this can... We can push this back. And Kinemon's like, this isn't the sort of thing you can push back. And Zoro's like, how do you know that? Rather than complaining about how it's impossible, how about you turn off your imagination and help?
It's a weird...
Off your imagination.
It's a weird thing for him to be like, shut up, stop thinking, dickhead. But it makes sense in the Zoro way of him being like, why don't you stop thinking that, something's impossible. But I think he says it like right afterwards. Like, I refuse to think that one man can do this. That's absurd. So let's fight against this instead of thinking it's unbeatable.
Right. I mean, surely if you get enough people who are powerful, you can hold back this technique that Doflamingo is using with only part of his intention. He tries to do that, and Frankie is on the same boat. He has instructed the Tonsada to push the Smile Factory, which is made of sea prism stone, into the strings, and since it's made of the stone, it will not be ripped apart, and so they're trying to use it to hold the birdcage back. So, smart plan as well. Robin points out, I was like, yeah, they're trying to push back against the cage. And he was like, I don't know if they could do it, but, I never thought about it. And Robin's just like, that is like Zoro, isn't it? That fucking idiot. Then fucking assholes from the Don Quixote family are like, the new royal plateau is off limits to anyone but the Don Quixote family, so get the fuck away. They basically just try and, hold the safest ground that they can. And then someone whacks him on the head. And it's all of the remaining gladiator fighters and all the people that were fighting on the side of the kingdom. And Bartolomeo's there!
At the forefront, so plus two Bartolomeo joined the Straw Hat points.
And they all joined up, and Kairos is there as well. And basically all the people, it seems, that have been defeated have found their second wind and are trying to do this. And Kairos says, all right, come on, everyone climb up the plateau. This is the center of the birdcage. And Sai says to everyone, no rest for the menfolk. If you're in good condition, you're coming with us. And Baby Five is just blushing behind him because...
He's super manly right now, Nick.
I mean, that is pretty badass. Like, no rest for the man. And everyone tries everything that they can. People who can't do anything are praying to Riku to save them. Sabo's fighting with Burgess. Frankie's leading the Tonta to push. Bartolomeo and the rest of them are like, come on, Luffy, you can do this. And Doflamingo's saying, show yourself, Straw Hat. And the chapter ends on the note of, time remaining until the birdcage reaches the center and causes genocide. 3 minutes. Time until Luffy's haki recovers. 4 minutes.
Dun, dun, dun.
And I believe at one point during the chapter, Doflamingo actually specifically said, fuck this, I'm going to speed things up.
Yeah, he notes, he's like, I'll just move the birdcage faster, basically that force way, you out.
That way Luffy will have to come in to fight me instead of running away. So.
Yeah. Really cool chapter. I love what we get in this final two-page spread. It's not like a two-page spread so much as it's a collection of things encompassed into two pages. And, you know, it's that thing I always mention where One Piece is at its best when it just feels chaotic, when there's so many things going on. You know, there's this fight with Sabo and Burris going on. You know, Doflamingo's tearing through the gladiators because Luffy's trying to recover Zoro and everybody's trying to push the factory. You know, the gladiators are all now revived and are trying to help out. Fujitora notices something up in the sky. Perhaps maybe his power is getting through it or something like that. You know, it's just so much going on, and it makes things so compelling when that happens. Because you're just like, oh, I need to see. Like, the tension's just so built up to do it. When this actually comes out in its Tankobon form, it's probably going to be, like, the highlight. I feel like this is the pinnacle chapter of things. Because everything after this is going to be kind of the follow-up. We're going to get our climax, our big moment where Luffy defeats Doflamingo. We're going to have our following actions after that. But this right here, this is, like, the swell of the tension right now, of the drama of seeing what's going to happen next. We're at the deadline.
This is what makes the climax worth it, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. Straighten up. They joined the club. Okay.
Oh, phew, okay. Toriko, something happens. World trigger.
Toriko, they learn what they have to go after. They have to meet with the third awesome chef, whose name is Gigi, and they're going after the next item in the super awesome menu. And World Trigger!
I like that we're just skipping over Toriko now.
This has not been a good couple of weeks. Ever since, basically, the Bambina battle ended, it's just like, yeah, I don't know. So... World Trigger is actually just a really long recap.
It is.
I was expecting that they would go on to something else, but for the most part, it's just recapping stuff, which is to drive home the point of, we know Tamakoma's strengths, but these are their weaknesses, and these are what they're going to have to address going into the next match, which is established at the very end of the chapter, after the captains of the two most important teams that they'll be going up against are introduced. So that's just kind of a little preamble to going through this, because we get this really long thing with a couple of really cool points by Tachikawa and Jin, as basically they go through their analysis of the matchup as a whole, because they establish, you know, the big thing was the fact that the bridge got taken out, and that really was to the detriment of Nasu Squad, because if they had met up, not Nasu Squad, Kuruma Squad, because if they had met up, they would have won. Like, hands down, because they would have been able to go through their usual strategy and stuff. And they make some notes on... They do kind of the thing that they have been doing through the majority of their commentary, which was... her name gets said in this fucking one. Mikami. Mikami, the announcer girl, you know, will say something... like, oh, well, it seems like, you know, they made the wrong decision there. They're like, well, yeah, but you're saying that based... on, you know, hindsight. And you can't do that. You can't say it's like, oh, they made the wrong decision. They made the best decision they could, and, you know, things just didn't go their way. And, you know, Tachiko is kind of really cutting to the point and stuff. There's an amusing bit where he'll say something because he says, you know, it's pointless to talk tactics looking only at results. And Mikami says, oh, I see. Yes, that's true. And Jin whispers over to him, yeah, Mikami already knows that. She's just saying this for the sake of analysis. And Tachiko is like, what, you mean I just embarrassed myself saying that?
I did like that, because it's we're both sports guys. There's so many times where a sports team, you know, a football team will go into a match, completely lose, and they'll be like, well, fucking that strategy of sticking to the run was dumb. And I mean, obviously there are points where you're like, we'll just change up the fucking, you know, pattern. But it is one of those things where, you know, in hindsight, if the team loses, automatically their plan was just the worst. And he's sort of like saying, right. Look, these guys' strategies, they weren't bad. They just didn't work.
It's kind of like, it's something that I think that even people outside of sports probably heard of around Super Bowl time, because it was such a controversial thing, where they were like, if they had just fucking given Marshawn Lynch the ball and run it up the middle, they would have won. And everyone's, and then you gotta go back and like, well, but everyone and their mother knew that was going to happen.
So they wanted to throw them off their game and try something different, you know?
It wasn't the fact that they chose to pass. It was, and they threw to a guy who had never intercepted a pass in his entire NFL career. It was just a matter of he was convinced they were going to throw towards him. And they did make mistakes on it. It was not the fact that they were going to throw the ball that screwed them over. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. And in this, I also like the fact that Mikami is, for once, not made out to be the most ignorant person. They just have this little throwaway line where they say she's just feigning ignorance in order to spark conversation among the color analysts. So
it's a good line.
Let's see. Then Tachikawa kind of notes on the match on the East Bank between Osamu and Nasu and all of them, and he says, Nasu could have easily defeated Mikimo one-on-one. And that is how it turned out. But Mikimo was fighting somewhere beyond that. From the beginning, he knew she would be a difficult opponent, so he decided to have her run out of try-on. I like how he's aware of his own shortcomings. So, getting a little compliment from a top guy there. Then they point out, it's like, Agent Amatori and stuff. And Tachiko says, I bet she was never in Natsu's range even once. Nasu was more powerful, but Mikimo was superior as a captain in his ability to strategize. And Captain Nasu is a leader as well as an ace, so she has more to bear. Or Jin says that bit. So it's interesting how they're really hammering this idea of aces and captains on the three-man squads. It seems like it's going to be something that's going to pop up throughout the rank wars.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Mikami also says, what do you think about Kuruma? He got that point at the end, and so Tachiko says, it seemed like they were going to be done for without Murakami, but he head out to the end, and maybe the invasion changed him. Maybe he's improved since then. And if Murakami doesn't have to babysit Kuruma and Taichi, Suzunari will rise even further, which implies we're not done with those guys. So.
Yeah, we got... It was a way to be... to kind of showcase everybody here a little bit. To kind of say, look, all these teams had their ups and downs. Some things worked for them, some things didn't. But they're all advancing. Here's kind of some evidence to, show what all their plans were, to also show how other teams have, made strides. Arashiyama improved because Katora became the ace. And then, it let, fucking whatever his name is. I know I just said it, but it let him focus on just becoming the captain. And maybe that would help if Nasu squad had somebody else become captain or somebody else became their ace,
Might very well happen because it seems like the team is going to have to break up.
Mm-hmm. So it's a cool way of kind of showing, look, there's a lot going on here, a lot of development. It is a tremendous amount of talking to the audience, essentially, during this. It's a lot of exposition being given. It works because...
But it's a good device to do it.
Yeah, it's it's a commentary team, so it actually makes sense that they are just explaining things to us. That's what a commentary team would do. And then...
It reminds me of Machine Gun Sonata from iShield 21. Conversation with the two different color analysts.
And,
he was just a fucking complete dope. He was like, let me explain what the fuck this means. For those of you stupid Japanese people who don't know what football is.
We don't understand it down yet. it ends, obviously, then with a preview of what's to come.
Right. So, immediately after, Tachikawa and Jin have had this very positive analysis to say for all this game, making note of their shortcomings, but saying, a lot of them exceed expectations, basically. We cut to a couple of guys who are sitting together and seemingly having a meal. First up is Kohei Izumi. We have seen him before because he's in Tachikawa's squad. And so he says, Four Eyes, his fighting was annoying in a good way, but almost dying, I guess, must really change a man. So, it's kind of interesting. And then immediately after he says that, and also, their sniper is really cool. It's almost like she has a black trigger. And then the guy he's talking to says, the white-haired kid aside, that cannon girl and Four Eyes are not an issue. Tamakoma didn't survive the East Bank on talent. It was pure luck. Tachigawa had some really lame commentary that day. And his name is Masataka Ninomiya, the number one shooter in B rank and their squad captain.
And he's the number two solo overall shooter.
Right. So he is fucking good, basically the best person in all of the B ranks. And he has Osama's position, and he is an opposing captain.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. And so basically, Izumi is kind of standing up a little bit. He's like, I don't know. You know, Four Eyes got the survival points like he wanted. He's like, yeah, but that's the hindsight that Tachika was talking about. He would have died a lot sooner if Nasus felt like it. And that quiet strategy, the flashy campfire, it doesn't matter. Neither the Cannon Girl nor Four Eyes has taken out a single person. They happen to profit off of Kuruma's hard work. In the previous matches, all the points have been scored by the white-haired kid. And that's a really important point to figure out, to point out. I mean, they've only had one loss in that whole time, but Yuma has gotten all of the kills.
Yeah.
So it brings back the point of, are they too reliant on Yuma? And it goes beyond that, though, because he really fucking lays into Osama. He says he's a small fry who dabbles in strategy. They can't win against them with both tactics and combat skills. You think too highly of them. Do you think Tamakoma 2 could beat your squad? And he's like, I don't know, I wouldn't go that far. And he's like, yeah, well, that's all there is to it. But he says, well, what about, you know, Amatori's firepower? You know, I saw her shoot an asteroid once, and it was ridiculous. He says, well, yeah, but no matter how much power there is, all she can do is demolish buildings, because today's match made it obvious that pint-sized cannon can't shoot people. Which is like, huh, she hasn't hit anyone, has
yeah,
she?
Yeah, and it is a pretty big deal for a girl who's scared as she is, she just wants to fight against neighbors. This is a situation where she has to kill somebody who's, you know, a fight against somebody who's alive, and when they get into an actual combat situation, you know, we've seen the neighbors are essentially people of their own rights. Can
right.
she...
The only neighbors that she helped take out were the monstrous ones, like the rabbits and stuff. Mm-hmm. Is she going to be able to take on the humanoids? And how is this going to hold them back in the rank wars?
Yeah.
So,
it's a very interesting development that seems to be alluding to the fact that we're going to get some character progression. I think... with Osamu, I don't know what we'll necessarily get, because he has a very good point. He's like, they can't win against somebody who has tactics and combat skills. Osamu won, or his strategy won them both of their past two matches because they came in with the right idea. You know, the first time it was having a diligently planned strategy that took the advantages of their four, you know, the other teams they were up against and turned them into, you know, against each other. And this one, it was just having a very quick reaction time and making the right call. But he's like, look, if they fight against someone who has that as well as being, you know, just physically superior, he can't win.
It's like, to go back to Daisho 21, it's like the point they established with, they're working really hard, and that's their main advantage in every match they have, the Temple Bats. But what if they go up against a team that is incredibly naturally gifted, and they also work their asses off? How are they going to possibly bridge that gap? How are they possibly going to win?
Yeah, like, that was the thing noted. Like, if Agon actually gave a fuck and trained, he would be an unstoppable player.
And that was what made Shin, you know, Senna's main rival was. He was ungodly talented, and he worked his fucking ass off.
Mm-hmm.
So how is Senna going to possibly defeat him?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the thing that's brought up. I was like, Osamu is not a very good fighter. He's an incredible strategist. But what if they go up against another incredible strategist, and they just have better pieces to work with? And the chapter ends kind of on this moment of reflection where Osamu's like, you know, I promised Yuma that I would get the points on this side, and despite that, I didn't score a single point. I haven't scored a single point this whole time. Even with the advantage, I couldn't finish off Nasu.
And then, you know, spoilers, they get the match update. They're going to be facing four teams, actually, this time, including Nanomiya squad and the number ranked 2 Kagiura squad, Azuma squad as well.
And so it's a fatal four-way team fight, and yeah, they're going to, but most importantly, they're going to be up against the top group with that Ninomiya guy, who is a tremendous douchebag about them.
He is a supreme ass. Like, I love... He's, like, sitting there, like, his fucking head tilted over in, like, a fucking sweater vest. Like, yes, yes, what a fucking help and all. And, like, just tearing them a fucking part. You're just like, oh, what an ass. But this guy's gonna fucking tear Osamu apart.
Yeah, but, you know, Osamu said, you know, just says to himself, well, we knew we'd have to face them sooner or later, and we have to beat everyone to make A rank. So, one of those things where it's like, yeah, we've been facing, you know, the lower tier teams and the middle tier teams, but if we want to do this, we've got to beat the best. So, let's just go do it. And I'm not actually very sure that they're going to do it this time around.
You know what? I wouldn't be shocked if this is one they end up losing, although I can't, like, I would like for them to lose, like, the idea of, like, they drop down a little bit and have to work back into it, or maybe they get right into another rematch against with like some of the top teams or something like that. But at the same time, like, this Rank Wars arc can't continue on that long. I feel
It is, as much as, this arc has seemed like it, this is not a sports series. Mm-hmm. So what are they going to do? I'm curious and I want to find out, so.
Yeah, it just needs to eventually move back into the larger plot of, like, hey, neighbors are out there. We can't continue it that long. But it would be, I can't see what Osamu does to beat Nanamiya. And that's the exciting thing of it. Like, maybe he doesn't. Well, I want to see what he'll come up with to get over it. I want to see, Chika get some development here. It makes me excited for the next match, but I am, like, at a point where I'm like, ooh, what can this guy do? This Nanamiya guy seems actually really good.
And we, are still establishing things that could come into play in the, grander scheme of things. The fact that Osamu is just not a good combatant. The fact that Chika has, still has self-preservation issues, which they're working on, but are they going to be able to work on the fact that she doesn't shoot people?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, good stuff. Looking forward to more. As with goddamn every chapter of World Trigger fucking ever, it seems, except for the first 30, but shut up.
can't keep holding it over our head, guys.
Yeah. So, that, I believe, is going to do it for this week of Weekly Manga Recap. It's going to be a little bit of an extra wait until the next episode as we get back into our regular schedule. We're going to be back to Wednesdays, hopefully, next week.
Yes.
Okay. I forgot how I do this. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap. We record the show live on twitch.tv/RoloT. Normally, we do it on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Of course, we had to change it up this week as well as last week. Sometimes we have to do that more, so just follow us on Twitter to know when we're going to be starting the show. Follow him at RoloT and me at YRolerOfTime. Also, be sure to send us your criticism, questions, critiques, suggestions for future manga for us to read. Either put them in the comments section or email them to us. weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com is the address, and that is the best way to contact us about for manga suggestions. Once again, that's weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com and follow us on iTunes, where you can leave a rating or a review and help us to beat the Woodworking Podcast. Assholes. Also, special thanks go out to Steve Mann, our title card artist. You can check out his work at narogfanboy.deviantart.com, idrawboobs.tumblr.com, and patreon.com/stevemann. Special thanks as well go out to The Infamous Planet and Felix Dark 2 for making the visual editions of our podcast. Okay, so the suggestion. I wasn't sure about this, but I figured, fuck it. We have gotten some strange suggestions for manga for us to do on
the show. I don't like the way this is going.
We have also covered some series that are not really manga so much as they are web comics from Japan and Korea. This is one of those cases, and everyone has assured us in making the suggestion, because it has been actually suggested multiple times for us to do it, that it is not the type of series that it initially appears to be. And I checked it out myself. I checked it out for the first several chapters just to make sure. There's a few moments where, yeah, it's not safe for work, but it's not explicit. It's Onani Master Kurosawa.
Oh, okay.
It's a series about a guy in high school who likes to jack off in the girls' bathroom. That is just the premise. It is not all that it is about. I swear. So that's what we're going to be doing, and if I talk too much more about it now, then it'll just take away, I think, from us talking about it next week or whenever we talk about it. So we'll hold off until then.
All right. I can dig it. Also, a shout-out to Sane796 for a 5-star review on iTunes. By golly, what a super swell show this is. Keeps me coming back each episode with its wacky banter. So, thank you.
All right.
We need to wrap this up and go home.
Okay.
I mean, I'm technically already home, and you're probably also already at home.
But
maybe we could switch. We could switch homes.
That will take a lot of work.
how about you send me over your house and I'll send you over my house one package at a time?
I'm sure that if we use an electronic delivery service that will work, so let's start Dropboxing that immediately. I'm sure that this can have no problems to it whatsoever.
Alright, here's my rent. Here's my mortgage forms.
Here is my wallet with all of my ID in it.
Here's my social security number. There you go.
And a sample of my blood.
Hey, Nick, is your name likes to steal credit at yahoo.com? Fuck, I'm just going to assume so.